let me say a couple of things about the handout first. There's at least one typo, three lines up from the end on the second page. It should, the line should end D given C, not D given A. And the other thing about the handout, so as not to raise your hopes, when you get to the end of the handout, you really haven't got to the end of the paper. I just wanted to get that proof there, and there's a bit more after that, given time. And also, perhaps there will be inevitably a little bit of overlap with this morning, because I'm also talking about Ramsey and pragmatism. So, pragmatism became the name of a philosophical movement founded by Charles Saunders Peirce in the late 19th century in the other Cambridge. And Peirce's work clearly influenced Ramsey, and Ramsey very plausibly influenced Wittgenstein in his transition from early to the more pragmatic late. Whether it is also true that Peirce influenced Wittgenstein was raised this morning, and I don't know the answer to that. But anyway, throughout the crucial year of 1929, the first of Wittgenstein's return to Cambridge, and the last of Ramsey's life, they had innumerable conversations, as Wittgenstein says in the foreword to the Investigations. So to the extent that there is a Cambridge pragmatist tradition, Ramsey is an important part of it. As a matter of fact, Wittgenstein said it was over 2 years, but this was written a long time after, and G.E. Moore says Wittgenstein must be misremembering. It would be over parts of two academic years, but it was the entire calendar year of 1929. So in this introductory section, I look briefly at some central pragmatist claims and attitudes and the way they show up in Ramsey. Then I'll talk a little bit about Ramsey on probability, and then about the approach to conditional judgments that I've adopted, which has its origins in Ramsey, to see how well that fits with contemporary pragmatism. At first sight, the verdict might seem mixed. I think it is a pragmatic approach to conditionals, but it's naturally construed in terms of a contrast with non-conditional categorical judgments, and has been thought of as essentially a local pragmatism and not particularly friendly towards pragmatism across the board. I don't really think that's right. It does involve a contrast, but there's nothing to prevent a pragmatic approach to the non-conditional statements, as far as I can see. Anyway, some pragmatist slogans. The Scottish philosopher Alexander Bain said, "Belief is that upon which a man is disposed to act," about which Peirce commented, "From this definition, pragmatism is scarcely more than a corollary." Well, it hardly merits the epithet definition, for belief is not the only thing upon which a man is disposed to act, a fact of which, of course, the pragmatists and Ramsey were well aware. Yet the slogan highlights the connection between belief and action, to which they were very centrally committed. And the so-called pragmatist maxim: consider what effects, which might conceivably have practical bearings, we conceive the object of our conception to have, then the conception of those effects is the whole of our conception of the object. And perhaps rather more perspicuously, the entire intellectual purport of any symbol consists in the total of all general modes of conduct which, conditionally upon all the possible different circumstances and desires, would ensue upon acceptance of the symbol. Those are both quotes from Peirce, and it's worth saying that Peirce used the term symbol very widely, and certainly to include belief. So Ramsey contributed to this pragmatist project in a couple of ways. First and most fully, In Truth and Probability, he gave an account of what it is to believe a given proposition to a certain degree, e.g. 3/4, what it is to be, say, 75% certain that P, in terms of the actions to which it would lead, given, of course, different possible circumstances and desires. And second, in Facts and Propositions, he gestures towards a pragmatic theory of meaning, according to which the meaning of a sentence is, I quote, defined by the actions to which asserting it, I think it would be better to say accepting it, would lead, or more vaguely still, by its possible causes and effects. That is, there is in Ramsey a commitment to a pragmatic theory of meaning, but it isn't really fully developed. The pragmatic maxims have, inter alia, a negative role to demonstrate the emphasis, the emptiness of anything such as a priori speculative metaphysics which makes no difference to practice. In this respect, pragmatism is a close cousin of the later positivism and verificationism, but with more, perhaps with more emphasis on action. And one sees sprinkled throughout Ramsey, really, this negative use of the principles. For instance, there is such a quantity as mass is nonsense unless it means merely to affirm the consequences of a mechanical theory. And from General Propositions and Causality, he says, but may there not be something which might be called real connections between universals? I cannot deny it, for I can understand nothing by such a phrase. What we call, and then he kind of spoils it by saying, what we call causal laws I find to be nothing of the sort. I mean, that suggests he did know what he was talking about. I'm reminded here of a remark I recall Dummett making once when replying to a paper and saying he didn't understand something, and he went on to say, I don't understand this. I don't say that, as some philosophers do, with an air of self-congratulation. There is that move, popular, of course, with positivists and verificationists and pragmatists, is one of which Ramsey was rather fond. And something similar to that move, I think, is going on in Ramsey's criticism of Keynes's theory of probability, which occupies an early section in Truth and Probability. Keynes postulates that between any two propositions, there exists a certain kind of logical relation, a probability relation of a certain degree, a sort of partial entailment, and it's by recognition of such relations that we proceed, if rational, from full belief in the one to partial belief in the other. And Ramsey's criticism is simply that he doesn't believe in the existence of such logical relations. And he says, if anyone would ask me what probability one gave the other, I should not try to answer by contemplating the propositions and trying to discern a logical relation between them. I'd rather try to imagine that one of them was all that I knew and to guess what degree of confidence I should have in the other. I.e., he really doesn't think that these relations are there, and even if they are, they don't seem to be doing any work. Ramsey's first reference to Peirce was in his review of Wittgenstein's Tractatus in Mind, 1923, when Ramsey was a mere 20 years old. And his most detailed attribution was in his pragmatic approach to induction in Truth and Probability. We judge mental habits by whether they work, whether the beliefs they lead to are for the most part true, or more often true than those which alternative methods would lead to. And he says there, on that passage there's a note saying what follows to the end of the section is almost entirely based on the writings of C.S. Peirce. And as I've indicated, even when Peirce is not referred to, there's quite a lot of evidence of influence. Sometimes One is given pause. For instance, when one reads at the end of Facts and Propositions, Ramsay says, "I must emphasize my indebtedness to Mr. Wittgenstein. Everything that I have said is due to him, except the parts that have a pragmatic tendency." Now, this is the Wittgenstein of the Tractatus, and a less pragmatic work would be hard to conceive, I think. So it's a bit like somebody saying, "I owe my politics entirely to Margaret Thatcher, except for the parts that have a Marxist tendency." Ramsay remains very faithful, very much, as it were, enamoured with Wittgenstein's conception of logic, and perhaps that it all fits in nicely. I'm not accusing him of inconsistency. Truth will come into the story later. Ramsay doesn't follow Persis' conception of truth as the opinion which is fated to be ultimately agreed by all who investigate, which personally is what we mean by truth. Ramsay had his own theory of truth. In fact, it comes in, as we heard this morning, two slightly different versions. The famous version in Facts and Propositions, and the later version in the manuscript on truth, published only in 1991, which came out of Pittsburgh, where they hold the Ramsay manuscripts. I don't think the difference between the two probably isn't going to be significant here. One difference is that truth is now, in the later manuscript, he says truth applies primarily to beliefs, whereas previously he said it applies primarily to propositions. And moreover, it doesn't get eliminated where there seemed to be a pressure towards eliminating it in the earlier work. It says B is true, mean is equivalent to, there is a P, B is the belief that P and P. As I say, I don't think the differences are going to be very significant here. And contemporary pragmatists tend to have a Ramsayan minimalist conception of truth rather than to follow Peirce or James. Okay, we heard a lot more about truth this morning, and it, as I say, it's going to come in the story a bit later. So turning to truth and probability. In the foreword to Truth and Probability, Ramsay says, in this essay, the theory of probability is taken as a branch of logic, the logic of partial belief and inconclusive argument. But there's no intention of implying that this is the only or even the most important aspect of the subject. Probability is of fundamental importance not only in logic but also in statistical and physical science, and we can't be sure beforehand that the most useful interpretation of it in logic will be appropriate in physics only. Indeed, the general difference of opinion between statisticians and logicians renders it likely that the two schools are really discussing different things. The conclusions we shall come to must not, therefore, be taken to prejudging its meaning in physics. So there had been long-running battles between those who took probability as a measure of reasonable belief and those who took it as an objective feature of the world. Peirce was on the objective side. I'm not sure about this, but as far as I know, Ramsay's is the first clear statement that we need two concepts of probability. He was followed by Carnap in this respect. And his words are remarkably like the opening words of David Lewis's A Subjectivist's Guide to Objective Chance. We subjectivists conceive probability as a measure of reasonable partial belief, but we need not make war against other conceptions of probability, declaring that where subjective credence leaves off, there nonsense begins. Along with subjective credence, we should also believe in objective chance. The practice and analysis of science requires both concepts. Neither can replace the other. So anyway, the problem Ramsay addresses in this essay is, what does it mean to say someone has a degree of belief of, e.g., 3/4 in a given proposition, 75% sure that be. He sets aside the possibility that this is to be explained in terms of the intensity of feeling of conviction. Not only would that make these things very difficult to measure, but he says it seems to be observably false, for the beliefs we hold most strongly are often accompanied by practically no feeling at all. No one feels strongly about things he takes for granted. He says, we are driven, therefore, to the supposition that the degree of belief is a causal property of it, which we can express vaguely as the extent to which we're prepared to act on it. Even if, he goes on to say, even if there were a more internal, introspective conception of strength of belief, it's to be put aside. Says the kind of measurement of belief with which probability is concerned is belief qua basis of action. So this was Ramsay's greatest and most lasting achievement of a pragmatist kind. If we knew a person's scale of values, we could measure their degrees of belief in terms of the gambles they're prepared to accept. If we knew a person's degrees of belief, we could measure their scale of values in the same sort of way by giving them choices. You say things, first you establish they prefer A to B to C, and then you say, would you prefer B for certain, or A if P, C if not P, where you know the degree of belief in P, or say a 60% chance of A against a 40% chance of C, that sort of thing. But the question is how to solve for both unknowns at once. And Ramsay found a way, using the rather quaintly named idea of an ethically neutral proposition believed to degree half. Those were the first things you identified. That is something like the coin lands heads. You have no intrinsic interest in whether it lands heads or tails, and by identifying those in terms of the gambles you're indifferent between, you can then get your scale of values and then use your scale of values to get other degrees of belief. Okay, there have been variants of what Ramsay did since in Savage and in Jeffrey, perhaps superior, perhaps more elegant, but it was Ramsay who gave the first solution to the problem, thereby initiating the subject of decision theory and indeed of subjective probability theory, which is an essential part of it, which has had very wide applications. He does see this, quite rightly, as something like as an idealized model. He wisely warns, I only claim for this approximate truth or truth in relation to an artificial system of psychology, which, like Newtonian mechanics, can, I think, still be profitably used, even though it is known to be false. Obviously, there's a lot of slippage, but as an idealized model, it has proved very fruitful. I think perhaps Ramsay makes a slip which is unusual, when he says that this project is a generalization of the view that the differentia of belief lies in its causal efficacy. And he says, okay, that has been tried and discussed by many philosophers, and here are a couple of objections that Mr. Russell has raised to it, and here are some replies. Although those projects are related, I don't think his project is a generalization of the other, as I understand what he means by the differentia of belief lies in its causal efficacy. That is, the question to be tackled is what makes a belief that P rather than a belief that Q? What makes it a belief that it's raining rather than a belief that it's Tuesday? And that is the project of a pragmatic theory of meaning. Ramsey's question, what makes my degree of belief that it's raining three quarters rather than a half, say, takes meaning for granted. The subject is taken to understand the options between which she has to choose. And so now we have three unknown. I mean, okay, if you... if we try to do all these things, we've got three unknowns, not two. And the philosopher who has tried to tackle that more general problem is Donald Davidson. Initially in the Dewey Lectures, which were published in the Journal of Philosophy 91, and in a couple of places since, how to go from preferred true of uninterpreted sentences and solve for the three unknowns, meaning, degree of belief, and degree of value or desirability. At least if I'm understanding what he means by the differentiator of belief lies in its causal efficacy, I think that's a slip. So turning to, still on truth and probability, let us turn to conditional degrees of belief. Ramsey introduces what he calls a very useful idea, the degree of belief in P given Q. And this quote, I think, is on your handout. This does not mean the degree of belief in P then Q, or that in P entails Q. I've always thought that that was a slip. They should have been the other way around, though that's the way it has always been reprinted. I mean, what he says is in a way too obvious. He should have said if Q then P. Or that which the subject would have in P if he knew Q, and that which he ought to have. It roughly expresses the odds at which he would now bet on P, the bet only to be valid if Q is true. And again, he says, this is not the same as the degree to which he would believe P if he believed Q for certain. For knowledge that Q might, for psychological reasons, profoundly alter his whole system of beliefs. And he states as one of his four fundamental laws of probable belief, degree of belief in P and Q equals degree of belief in P times degree of belief in Q given P. Note, he doesn't define degree of belief in Q given P as the ratio that you'd get by dividing both sides by the degree of belief in P. One reason, I can have a degree of belief in Q given P without having any definite degree of belief in P. I might be quite confident of the... have a quite confident degree of belief that the coin will land heads if you are on the supposition that, given that, you toss it, but absolutely just haven't given any thought to how likely it is that you will toss it. Also, it's far more common to arrive at the degree of the way he has it there, the degree of belief in the conjunction on the left via the two factors on the right rather than vice versa. Indeed, there's evidence that that was the need which gave rise to the idea of conditional probability. You're not going to, whatever kind of probability you're talking about, you're not going to go very far in probability theory without asking how likely is it that two things will happen, P and Q, and you need the notion of conditional probability to answer that question. Also note his remarks about what it is not. He doesn't mean that it's never what you would believe in P if you learned Q for certain. He means that it isn't necessarily that, so not reducible to that. The sort of case he hints at in the last quote is like one mentioned by Stolnicker. Anne may be such that if she were to discover that she had a terminal disease, she would acquire a belief in God. But that doesn't mean that she now has a high conditional belief in God's existence on the supposition. Suppose I have a terminal disease. Well, that makes it very likely that God exists. She doesn't think that at all. Perhaps quite the opposite. And there are other cases that have been given. There are the we'll never find out examples. Suppose that Reagan was in the pay of the KGB, then we'll never find out. Well, then if you did acquire a belief in the antecedent, you wouldn't go on and say you never find out. And in general, there are all sorts of ways you can acquire the belief that P, and there'll always be some extra information that you acquire, and that might affect what you think about So there's no reduction. He doesn't define conditional degree of belief at all. He says it's roughly to be explained in terms of the odds at which you would bet on P, the bet to be called off unless Q. There's no reduction of conditional degrees of belief to unconditional degrees of belief. So let's turn now to general propositions and causality, the famous footnote and its consequences. If two people are, this is the famous footnote, if two people are arguing if P then Q and are both in doubt as to P, they're adding P hypothetically to their stock of knowledge and arguing on that basis about Q. They're fixing their degrees of belief in Q given P. That is relating ordinary conditional judgments to conditional degrees of belief. The idea is that that's the way we assess conditionals. We suppose, add hypothetically, the belief that the antecedent is true, and consider what we think about the consequent under that supposition. And Ramsey says, our conduct is largely determined by these degrees of hypothetical belief. So a bit about what happened subsequently. In the 1960s, Ernest Adams developed a theory of conditionals conforming to Ramsey's footnote. Most importantly, he developed a logic for arguments with conditionals among their premises and conclusion in terms of the preservation of probability rather than truth. Take an uncontroversially valid argument, a necessarily truth-preserving argument, not containing conditionals. It's demonstrable that it also has this property. The improbability, 1 minus the probability, of the conclusion can't exceed the sum of the improbabilities of the premises. Now, Adam's thought could be put like this. Truth conditions for conditionals, if any, are elusive, but we do seem to know how to assess them as more or less credible, Ramsey's way. So let's develop a logic which respects the preservation of probability, including conditional probability, and an interesting and plausible logic for conditionals emerges. Robert Stolnaker was also impressed by Ramsey's footnote and by Adams's work. His project in the late 60s was to fill the gap noted by Adams, to find the proposition such that the probability of its truth is measured in the Ramsey-Adams way. He was working in the framework of possible world semantics, and he thought he had found the required proposition. He did find a proposition which generated a logic which agreed with Adams, which that was a constraint on the success of the project. For propositions, necessary preservation of truth and necessary preservation of probability go hand in hand. Then David Lewis proved, and this was 1972, published in 1976, that the project must fail. There is no proposition such that necessarily, that is, in all probability distributions, the probability of its truth is the conditional probability of one thing given another thing. Conditional probabilities can't be made to behave like unconditional probabilities, the latter being the probabilities of the truth of propositions. Thinking that B is probable on the supposition that A is not equivalent to thinking something or other is probable, i.e. probably true simpliciter. As I'll go on to say, you can cook up a proposition that will do the trick in a particular state of information on a one-off basis, but it's unstable. Change your information in a perfectly innocuous way and the equivalence comes apart, which is what Lewis showed, and there's a stronger result that I'll mention later. Ramsey intuited Lewis's result. Here's another quote from General Propositions and Causality. Many sentences express cognitive attitudes without being propositions, and the difference between saying yes and no to them is not the difference between saying yes and no to a proposition. This is even true of the ordinary hypothetical. Indeed, it might be that remark and one or two other similar remarks that spurred Lewis to find a proof. So, to begin with, I thought, look, I'm not going to actually give the proof, and then I realized I had to. So now I gave a trial run at Birkbeck in which I didn't, and it didn't work. So we have to actually look at a Lewis-style proof with an eye to the question, look, is anything unfriendly to pragmatism being assumed here? So, assume there's a proposition, if A, B, such that its probability, i.e. the probability of its truth, is, in a systematic sort of way, the probability of B given A. First ask, what are its logical relations to its parts? And first we prove three unparadoxical things about it. We prove first three things. It must be entailed by A and B, it must be incompatible with A and not B, and it must be neither entailed nor by nor incompatible with not A. Proofs, well, I'll give the first one. Suppose if the probability of A and B is 1, then the probability of B given A is 1. So, as we're assuming that that's the same as the proposition, the probability of if A, B is 1. If the entailment didn't hold, it should be possible to have probability of A and B 1, and the probability of if A, B less than 1, but it isn't. So, second one is absolutely similar. So, in a way, that means that the proposition must be such that A and B is sufficient for it, A and not B is sufficient for its being wrong. So it means, if you like, that the first two lines of the truth table are just fine. I say that because we use that in the next part. The next part is to show that we can't have if we had A B entailed by not A, then, given what we've already got, it would just be the material conditional, and we know that it is not in general equal to B given A. If we had if A be incompatible with not A, then, given what we already know, it would simply be the conjunction A and B, and we know that that, in general, is not equal to B given A. So, we've shown that, which is perfectly unparadoxical, we have four exclusive and exhaustive possibilities. Let's say our degrees, which you have there, A and B, if A, B, A and not B, not if A, B, not A and if A, B, not A and not if A, B. So that we must just have degrees of belief in them that sum to one, because they're exclusive and exhaustive, and call those P1 to P4. The probability of if AB is the sum of 1 and 3, because those are the two in which if AB is true. The probability of B given A is 1 divided by 1 plus 2. It's the probability of A and B divided by the two possibilities in which A is true. So that's what it must look like. So you can rig things up so that these are equal. In many probability distributions they're not, but rig things up so that they're equal. For example, let the four numbers be 0.3, 0.2, 0.3, 0.2. You're going to have the probability of if AB equals the probability of B given A equals 0.6. So the only assumption, we now make an assumption much weaker than the assumption that Lewis makes in his proof, and I hope you agree that it's innocuous. If you have a number of exclusive and exhaustive possibilities, and then you eliminate just one of them, you do not thereby eliminate any other possibility incompatible with the eliminated one. I mean, you can chuck out one and the others remain. Now, that's where things begin to go wrong. Suppose you have these four possibilities and then you eliminate A and B. Well, that sends the probability of B given A to zero. You know it's not A and B. If it's A, it's not B. But it doesn't send the probability of if AB to zero because it's true at line three, which has not been eliminated. And similarly, just the same, suppose you eliminate line two. You eliminate A and not B. So that takes the probability of B given A to 1, but it does not take the probability of if AB to 1, because it's false at line 4, which has not been eliminated. So that's what I mean by saying the equality is fragile and easily upset. Now you could get round the result at a cost by claiming that the conditional expresses a different proposition in each belief state, that it's hyper-context sensitive, this proposition. Any change in belief and you're actually saying something different to it, maybe. But Stolnaker, who himself, after Lewis, gave a different proof, and his only uses a single belief state, and he shows that if we do this rigging up to get them equal, we can find another pair of propositions, C and D, built out of A, B, and if A, B, such that demonstrably probability of if C, D is not equal to the probability of D given C. That was the typo I mentioned. Lesson, which I hope sounds a bit like a tautology. When you're considering whether if A, B, you're only interested in, or you only need be interested in what happens if A. You need not concern yourself with how things are if not A. But for any truth bearer, which may or may not be true if not A, you do need to concern yourself with what happens if not A. So no truth bearer does the trick. It's quite, I just say in parenthesis, we can, if we like, put aside the question whether this is the way we actually assess, or the question whether it is the way we ought to assess conditionals. It's certainly a possible way of assessing conditionals, and the conclusion is still puzzling for people who assess conditionals this way. They are not assessing truth evaluable propositions. So the result is puzzling, and the people who like it least tend to fall into two opposing camps. There's the staunch truth-conditional semanticist who doesn't want to forgo the virtues of explanations in terms of truth conditions. And on the other hand, there's the minimalist about truth, for whom truth is so innocuous that you shouldn't be able to rule out its application to some bit of language to which it prima facie applies. And in a way, the puzzle is that Ramsey is the source of that view we shall focus on is the source of the latter view as well. I think I will better skip going through Ramsey on truth. So the question is, if truth is such a thin notion, can it be right to say that it doesn't apply to conditionals and other types of judgment where its application is controversial in philosophy, such as, for example, ethical judgments? Doesn't everything he said on that occasion was true fulfill its function when what he said was, today is Sunday, what you're doing is wrong, and if you keep on doing that, you will be punished? Can there be a case for denying truth to conditionals while still being a minimalist about truth? Well, I'm going to cite a number of philosophers, including Ramsey, who would say, yes, there can. And the point is really that to be a minimalist about truth is not necessarily to be particularly liberal about what it takes to be a bearer of truth. Here is Lewis to this effect. Lewis has a very nice paper in Analysis 2001, published very, very shortly after his death, where he is defending a minimalist notion of truth, but also arguing that there are plenty that one might still be quite stringent about the sort of things to which truth applies. So this is Lewis. I take our topic to be, in the first instance, the truth of propositions. Sentences, or sentences in context, or particular assertions of sentences, or thoughts, can be derivatively be called true, but only when they succeed in expressing determinate or near enough determinate propositions. A sentence or dot 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 might fail to express a proposition because it is ambiguous, or because it's vague, or because it's paradoxical or ungrounded, or because it's not declarative, or because it's a mere expression of feeling in the syntactic disguise of a declarative sentence. He has a footnote at this point. When people in philosophy books go to the footy, they express their feelings by saying boo and hooray. Real people use a wider range of expressive expressions. Some of them have at least the superficial form of declarative sentences. Leeds boot boys rule, or Collingwood sucks. Clearly it's Australian football. A pompous bystander might indeed respond to such a sentence by saying that's true or that's false, but calling it doesn't make it so, unless the sentence did, after all, express a true or a false proposition. The bystander's response would be just a piece of make-believe. So that's the end of the footnote. So these things, such a sentence, we had a long list, is not a candidate for the status of truth simpliciter, but it may be a candidate for a related status, such as truth on all or some of its disambiguations, truth on all or most or few of its precisifications, or make-believe truth. Or, one might add, following a couple of examples from Hartree Field, it could be truth relative to a set of norms, truth relative to a frame of reference, or in the case we're interested in, perhaps truth relative to a supposition. B can be true relative to a supposition. So anyway, the point, well, another example that occurred to me is we have to often drum into our students that we don't call arguments true or false. I was reading a dissertation on conditionals in linguistics recently, and the person was doing that all the time. So anyway, for Lewis, clearly minimalism about truth is compatible with fairly stringent requirements on when a sentence or utterance is a candidate for truth. And Ramsey's view was similar. Ramsey didn't say there was no problem of truth, but no separate problem of truth separate from the analysis of judgments. Truth and falsity are ascribed primarily to propositions, he also said in 1927. And much of the paper in which the footnote occurs, General Propositions and Causality, is devoted to arguing that, I've already quoted this, many sentences express cognitive attitudes without being propositions. This is, and the difference between saying yes or no to them is not the difference between saying yes or no to a proposition. This is even true of the ordinary hypothetical. The main business of this paper of Ramsey's is to argue that judgments of causal law, also called variable hypotheticals, are not judgments about propositions. He says variable hypotheticals are not judgments, but rules for judging. If I meet a phi, I shall regard it as a psi. This cannot be negated, but it can be disagreed with by one who does not adopt it. A variable hypothetical is not strictly a proposition at all, and the difficulty comes fundamentally from taking every sentence to be a proposition. So Ramsey's position, or I should say put it the other way, is like Lewis's. I should probably put that the other way around. Minimalism about truth combined with quite a stringency about what it takes to be a bearer of truth. And I'm almost over. Another minimalist about truth, Quine, in Methods of Logic, says, now, under what circumstances is a conditional true? Even to raise this question is to depart from everyday attitudes. An affirmation of the form if PQ is commonly felt less as an affirmation of a conditional than as a conditional affirmation of the consequent. If after we've made such an affirmation, the antecedent turns out to be true, then we consider ourselves committed to the consequent. If, on the other hand, the antecedent turns out to be false, our affirmation is as if it had never been made. So that quote shows that one doesn't have to be a friend of propositions, as Quine is not, to find reason to doubt whether a given kind of sentence or utterance is a bearer of truth. And I think it must be common ground that some sentences are not truth bearers, and syntax is too crude a device to determine which are. Sentences which are truth bearers have a certain kind of use, express a certain kind of mental state with a certain kind of role, and it's open to detailed argument in cases of controversy whether a given kind of sentence plays this role. Last paragraph. There is a way, with costs and benefits, of following the Ramsey of the famous footnote with a partial reinstatement of truth values for conditionals, and say that a conditional is true if it has a true antecedent and consequent, false if it has a true antecedent and false consequent, and has no truth value if its antecedent is false. All the problems with assigning truth values arise for the case in which the antecedent is false. If we do this, say this, we need to give up some cherished notions. It's no fault in a conditional that it has a false antecedent and hence is not true. It's no merit in a conditional that it has a false antecedent and hence is not false. Beliefs and assertions don't aim at truth. It's only true if A and B. Rather, we want our conditional judgments to be true on the assumption that they are either true or false, i.e. that the antecedent is true, and or on the assumption that they have a truth value, true on the assumption that they're either true or false. The probability of a conditional is not the probability of its truth, which is A and B, but the probability that it's true, given that it's either true or false, which is roughly equivalent to Ramsey's idea. This is the line taken originally by De Fanetti, who in Italy, independently of Ramsey, developed a theory of subjective probability, I think roughly 10 years later. And I find it interesting that each came to think that conditional probability was the key to conditional judgments in general. A minimalist about truth will have some trouble with that option, however, for it departs from the central tenet of minimalism. On this option, it is true that if A, B is not equivalent to if A, B. Whereas Ramsey's own view, I've argued, is quite consistent. Minimalism about truth combined with the denial that our hypothetical judgments are truth bearers. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Should
okay.
We sit?
Yeah.
Just sit there. So we have plenty of time for questions. We will apply the same Australian rules as you announced this morning. So who would like to start? All right.
Yes, just on the Lewis view, the sort of minimalism that it's compatible with. So one of the things that I thought was attractive about minimalism is that if you have a language L in any sentences, then the only thing you understand those sentences, you don't know which ones are special propositions, you just understand the sentences. And the only thing you need to do to grasp the additional predicate T and L is the scheme. But on the that's what I typically part of what's attractive about minimalism. But that bit of minimalism seems incompatible with Lewis.
Yes, and indeed with the quiet book as well. Yeah. Well, that's great. I take your point, but Lewis thought, the Quine thought is, look, isn't it common ground that at least some sentences aren't true? One of his grounds is they're not declarative, right? And then his examples of expressions of feeling and so on. Isn't that view too simple? But there certainly could be things that have the disguise of a declarative sentence, which are simply like saying good, hooray, or whatever. I mean, okay, that's a very nice simple view, but isn't it too simple? I suppose it would be.
But yeah, I think I disagree with that. We have to acknowledge that it does lose some of the
trust. Yes, I think that may be. Yes.
Julie Tan.
A lot of what you said, or some of what you said about Ramsey at the end on conditionals and not necessarily being truth bearers, sounds a lot like Lyle.
Yes, I agree.
And now I have a question about something that I see in Lyle, it's kind of obscure. I wonder if this might be true of Ramsey as well. And that is, he talks about statements in textbooks, say, that are statements that talk about what a doctor should do, can easily be called true or false, but you need to assess them on virtue of what makes them true, in the sense that you try to find something in the world that either the truth makers. On the contrary, what you would do in trying to understand those kinds of claims would be to see that they are actually congealed descriptions of good advice that a doctor could give to his patient.
Mm-hmm.
and that these textbooks now are just taking that advice and turning it into generalizations to give doctors about what to say. And so you can only understand what's good about those statements which are look like they're truth-bearing by actually going down the practice to see where these came from and what role they were playing. And in their original roles, they were not truth apt. They were good or bad pieces of advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had read Ryle as inference digits, as denying that traditional that we bear. Somebody, it didn't get into print, but he tried to reply that for Ryle it was not at all incompatible with saying that they're truth bearers. So that anyway, that's...
There's some, of them are inference tickets, Dorothy, but some of them, I think he's going to have a very, some will be inference tickets, laws are going to be inference tickets, but there are other kinds that could be playing other kinds of roles.
Well,
conditional threats are not inference, well.
Is one reading it now as something like, we have it on authority that in the patient, blah, 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 blah. I mean, that's how it's come down as a piece of established advice in a textbook. We must follow this because the textbook says so.
No, I was giving the example of ethical advice as an analogy with the conditional. It's an example of a claim that looks like a statement. It would be true or false. The doctor should do this. But it's truth. So it's a different kind of statement. Something that's truth apt, but doesn't get its truth in the standard kind of way. Mm-hmm. You have to go down and look at the practice. And then a similar claim. I think it was just a question. Does any of that show up in Ramsey when he talks about something that might be truth assessable? Where it gets its truth maker from might be much more complex in the practice.
That's a good question. I really could well be. I don't really know. Thank
you. Dorothy, this sort of model of leaning on the notion of proposition in order to as it were.
Yeah.
Decide where your deflation notion of truth is going to be applicable and where it's not going to be applicable. The sort of problem with it, it's always seemed to me, is that the task of deciding where the genuine propositions are is really no harder.
Mm-hmm.
And I also thought that this was a problem which Ramsey would have sooner encountered himself if he'd lived a bit longer. Because he would have seen that the considerations about generality which were on the table in general propositions and causality, which were leading you to say that certain kinds of generality were an indication that we didn't have propositions in play. Once you had the rule following considerations, which went very far down the track at that point, then you have the view that this kind of generality is everywhere in language.
Yes.
And then, as it were, it looks like the idea that we have genuine propositions at all kind of collapsed from the inside.
Yeah.
So there seems to be a kind of instability in the picture.
Right.
Do you have any sense?
Yeah. Well, I've never been very attracted to what he says about general propositions there. And one of his reasons seems to be a distaste for infinity. It's difficult to disentangle what's going on because part of it is meant to be distinguishing law-like generalizations from accidental generalizations. He says he has no problem about the truth of everyone in Cambridge voted, though I think he actually should have. He says that's just a conjunction, which I don't think it is. I mean, A voted and B voted and C voted and so on. It doesn't say everybody voted. And So that's part of it, and part of it is those with finite scope and those with infinite scope, and those don't really line up because there can be sort of, William Neal, who brought in the phrase, accidents on a cosmic scale, very easily can be. And indeed, Dave Lewis has an example of a Hall-like statement that only has about, because about the planets, it only has about 7 or 8 instances. So it's hard to see quite what is driving it, but a lot of it seems to be this. I mean, Dave Lewis says infinite collections is nonsense. There's another thing of nonsense, right? Even on propositions, he's a bit ambivalent, because a lot of the time he's saying propositions are the primary bearers of truth, and lots of these other things that aren't cognitive attitudes are not always attitudes to propositions. But there are a couple of places where he says he more or less agrees with Russell that there is no such thing as Caesar died in his bed, sort of thing, you know. Which always struck me as very strange, because that seemed, it seemed to me that you should only have that worry if you were very much in the copy theory of truth maker kind of, you know, it's all right to have something out there for the true ones, but what do you have for the false ones? So I agree, it kind of looks as though, also, as I mentioned, and was, there is a shift in this later piece of truth that the draft of the beginnings of a draft of a book on truth, there he says the primary bearers of truth are belief, our beliefs, that is a change. So it does look as though the worry is we're relying too much on just this notion of opposition. However, look, the argument that I spelled out doesn't seem on the face of it to me to assume against thinking that conditionals assessed this way are not true. It doesn't seem to me to have to be assuming anything. It's just talking about compatibilities and incompatibilities between propositions. It doesn't seem to be assuming anything that, or sentences if you prefer, anything that people squeamish about propositions should balk at. Then I have also the quote from Quine, for what it's worth.
Yes, I think my worry was that in the end it would have turned out that they were kind of, I mean, as it were, you were setting things up in terms of a contrast between conditional and regular propositions. And I think my worry was that Ramsey would have come to see as a result, at least if he'd gone on being moved by these worries about infinity, which are of course very pragmatist sorts of worries, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. what's the practical significance of the infinity, as it were, how do we latch onto these things? That way of putting it makes it clear that in some sense it seems to be very much like some of the worries underlying the rule form consideration.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm right that there's a kind of slippery slope which Ramsey would have found himself going down in that way, such that more or less all of language became infected with these same sorts of worries about infinity, then I think what would have to go would be the idea that there was a clear cut, so there was a nicely delineated class of genuine propositions, mm-hmm. so the picture would have to end up more messy in mm-hmm. some way.
Mm-hmm.
So that it could have some sort of version of the picture whereby, as long as certain sorts of things weren't in play, then things behaved like propositions and we got applied truth pretty normally. And that could be true of conditional cases too, as sort of under a supposition or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be going in effect would be the nice sort of bifurcation between the genuinely propositional cases and the non-propositional cases. Although some of these kinds of things that you want to say about what an Abbey called the non-propositional cases could still be said.
Yes, I think that's probably right. Thank you.
Comment on this, Hugh.
Well, I mean, it's just, yes, it is a comment. I mean, I think you could exaggerate what he says about generalisation. In general proposition of equality, what he's talking about, there's a problem about the difference between what makes a generalisation true. And he thinks that's obvious. It's just that, you know, all A's are B's are true, all A's are B's, that's the end. Not that it doesn't have truth, but that's not what you believe. That's not how you believe it, for all sorts of reasons, especially if the number of A's is infinite. What you do is, and then he has this talk about it, it certainly doesn't follow that the statement doesn't have a truth value. It just follows that if you're trying to explain, this is it. The main things are, we need to explain what it is to have a belief of which that's the content. And it isn't the content, can't be identified what makes it true. That's not unlike the question arising from what Julius said about Ryle and inference tickets. The comment I've always liked about Ryle and inference tickets on laws is Eyre's comment that, I'm not remembering verbatim, but the gist of it is, maybe it's having a ticket if there aren't any trains. And the point is, it's not the existence of a particular train which would take you there on that ticket. That's not what the ticket says. But unless that's the case, the ticket is no use. Mm-hmm. So I think, I mean, and just as this doesn't really, but there's no reason, I see no reason why, from what Ramsey says in general proposition of equality, that you should go down and end up at the bottom of that slope with, mm-hmm. with my phonetic namesake.
Well, he does say they're not propositions.
But I've said what I'm going to say, yes, that's part of it. This is all we've got to do with how you should use the word proposition.
Okay,
yeah. I think he's done anything more to that.
Phonetic namesake.
Dorothy, I mean, if he, as you said, he in the unpublished manuscript, he shifts from talking about propositions to talking about beliefs. Mm-hmm. Then, in a sense, that's I think going more in the other Hugh's direction, and sort of in a sense getting him off the hook too, because I mean, you know, it's easier to talk about what the beliefs are because we can do that functionally.
Yes.
All
right, sir.
Yeah, I have a question about the relationship between Paris and Ramsey, which is at the beginning of the paper. And and Ramsey adopting the pragmatic maxim to arrive at this conclusion that the semantics of conditionals is not truth functional. Well, of course, Peirce has a very different view, not so much on conditions, but on the interpretation of probability. And here I confess not to know Ramsey's views sufficiently to know to what extent he may have agreed. But of course, Peirce did believe in the reality of chance.
Yes.
And he thought it was consistent with the pragmatic maxim to accept that there were generally dispositional properties in the world that ensued probabilities, and he tended to interpret probability along the lines of chances. He's notorious as one of the founders of the propensity interpretation of probability. And so it is surprising, perhaps, to see Ramsey using that maxim to arrive at a different notion of probability. So on Peirce's view, at least, some conditional probabilities seem to be perfectly well truth valued, and we may agree or disagree regarding their truth a value, but they seem to express genuine propositions about the nature of the world. So.
Okay. Well, as I said, Ramsey, he didn't say an awful lot about it, but he did hint that he does want there to be such a thing as objective probability as well as degree of belief. He has no quarrel with that, and indeed he has some, not much expression, you know, he says, just for the sake of argument, let's call it relative frequency, but I don't really agree with that. So it sounds as though he would be content enough with the notion of objective chance, or even perhaps propensity. I don't think he says very much about it, but it wouldn't be incompatible with anything Ramsey says. But now look, there is anybody who is has a place for objective probability, is not going to quarrel with the idea that the objective chance of such an, of A is such and such constitutive value, or the objective chance of B given A is such and such, of the coin landing heads, or of my picking a red ball if it has a black spot, or whatever, having such and such, and is 70% or something like that. And indeed, many people would say that our subjective degrees of belief should try to mirror the objective probabilities. But that wouldn't help give a truth value to, if you pick a red ball, it will have, this doesn't have probability in it. If you pick a red ball, it will have a black spot. Is that true or false? If you pick a red ball, it has a 70% chance of it. That can be a okay, so I don't think
that, there's that conditional with a probabilistic statement in the consequent that is that may be true or false. The one that you just uttered, if you say
it doesn't really help to put it in the consequent, because you haven't, it is a conditional probability. It's not.
What I'm suggesting is that there are some conditionals that cannot have truth values in any case, but there are many other conditionals where if you the probability and the consequent, what you get makes sense.
It's a bad idea to put the probability in the consequent. Here is an argument.
In every case.
Yes, well, it's very, very rare that you get anything useful. I mean, if you can more or less prove that all probabilities are one and zero, at least given the law of excluded middle. If it rains, we'll very probably get wet. If it doesn't rain, we'll very probably stay dry. Therefore, either we'll very probably, if it's in the consequent, either we'll very probably get wet, or we'll very probably stay dry. That's wrong. It could be about 50-50. It's just, you don't get anything very useful by putting probabilities in the consequent rather than considering them as conditional probabilities.
Sure.
This doesn't address your question about the conditional probabilities, but Peirce and Ramsey, I think, were identical in terms of them wanting an objective and a subjective account of probability.
Okay.
So they do have the same solution to the single case problem. And the way Peirce puts it is this: we have to understand that logic, and in this case probability, is rooted in the social principle. So my interests go beyond my own success and have to be expanded. And, success speaks to the whole community, and hence it's habits of action that are justified or not in exactly what the family said. So they both made room or wanted to acknowledge a subjective and an objective side to the problem.
Okay, well that's interesting. I didn't know that. So something I had read said Peirce is on the objective side.
Well, he did. He was very clear that there was objective chance in the universe, he said, and he was probably the father of the propensity theory. But Ramsey gets this thought that logic is a normative science directly from Peirce, and it's just a small step from that to this solution of the single case problem, and you can't offer that solution of the single case problem without thinking that probabilities accrue to beliefs, right?
Do I have a question about, just for information about, from those who know Ramsey. Dorothy, you mentioned that he said he learnt everything from Peirce apart from let's see if you can get him with Stein or something.
The other way around.
And Cheryl mentioned Peirce this morning. I seem to recall Ramsey saying, "My pragmatism comes from Mr. Russell."
It's true, he does say that, yes. I've wondered about that too.
Completely unclear.
I mean, this would be post the analysis of mine, which didn't seem so very, at least a functionalist work about, about the nature of mental states. And,
therefore, I think, you know, consistent with a lot of practice studies mm-hmm. of the thesis we're hearing this morning.
Thank you. Lucas?
Yeah, so that's a question about the relation of indicative conditioners to contractual. Mm-hmm. So we've seen a proof that there can be a superposition to which you have to send the degree of relief S to the indicative conditioner. And that proof doesn't carry over to counterfactuals, simply because we don't usually have the same degree of relief in the counterfactual that had A been mm-hmm. the case that B would have been able to get in the B given A. Mm-hmm. So do you think there are any other reasons to relief relating to our epistemic attitudes that counterfactual conditioners don't express propositions either? Or if there aren't such reasons, would it be quite surprising to find out that two statements that in our everyday use seem to be very intimately connected are so radically different, such that one is a valuable in truth and the other one isn't?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's a very good question that I didn't touch on. I should have made clear that we're just talking about indicative conditionals here. Many of the people who do follow Ramsey and Adams on indicative conditionals take the line that you suggested at the end, that counterfactuals are a different story, they do a different job. Gibbard, for example, Bennett, for example, and they have something like along the lines of Lewis's truth conditions. I myself think that the arguments can be extended to counterfactuals, and that the relations, as you put it, the close relation between the two are to be, although of course we know that there's Oswald Kennedy sort of cases such that you go one way on the indicative and the other way on the counterfactual. Nevertheless, you can extend the arguments to counterfactuals too. Perhaps if you just think of the chancy ones, you get the idea that suppose the doctor tells me that there's a 90% chance that I'll be, or the doctor says she thinks it's 90% likely that I'll be cured if I have the operation, and then I don't have it, and then the doctor says, well, it's 90% likely that she would have been cured if she had had it. And this, I claim that the same sort of considerations go through there. There need be no yes-no answer to those. The answers will typically be somewhere between 1 and 0.
I'd like to just come back, if I may, to the discussion you're having with Hugh and Hugh about propositions and see if I understand what's going on there from the point of view of a pragmatist. I mean, you said you can have a sort of minimalist view in the way that Ramsey and others express this view without going all the way with, say, Simon, for example, thinking that one can just apply the truth predicate to any kind of proposition regardless of its kind of sentence or something. Claim, rather than its specific content. I think the thing you quoted from Lewis said that propositions are the primary bearers. Now, that might not help you because I don't have a very intuitive grip on what propositions are. So, in the discussion with Hugh, you suggested that, so you might think beliefs are things
okay.
that are primary
bearers.
Propositions are a kind of abstraction
yes.
from that. So then is the question whether, is the question that say would divide the ultra minimalist or the extreme minimalist and the position attributed to Ramsey and others, whether certain subject matters are susceptible of belief, or is that?
I suppose so. I think one might be able to rewrite that rather long quote I had from Lewis in terms of belief. A belief might fail to be true because it's ambiguous or vague or blah blah blah. And then I did say at one point, as far as conditionals are concerned, okay, you really okay. In a broad sense, you have conditional beliefs, but they are to be thought of as a belief in the consequent under a supposition rather than a belief full stop. And so I'm not absolutely sure that I would obviously that's a worry. You raised that one wouldn't want it to rest on too controversial, or certainly to from this the point of view of our present topic, too non-pragmatic kind of propositions. Yeah.
Sorry, did I misrepresent you, Sam?
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
You. I'd just like to come back to Ramsey and Lewis on probability. If you have Ramsey as somebody who has an objective notion of chance, then from one point of view, his objection to Keynes looks a little bit odd. Because you might say, well, Keynes is giving us a kind of view of objective chance. It's just couched in terms of logical relations between propositions, and so some of the ontology of it looks a bit odd, but basically it's a view according to which there's something objective which ought to determine our degree of belief in various things in various circumstances. And Ramsey's objection to it isn't an objection to it being too linguistic in relating propositions or anything like that. It's more a kind of pragmatist objection in terms of I can't see how anything like this would be relevant. Mm-hmm. And of course that's a familiar kind of pragmatist objection to objective chances. And in a sense it's the one that, or at least close to the one that Lewis has when he says about certain views of objective chances. Don't call anything chance until you show me how it constrains credence. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of Lewis's subjective side in play.
Yes.
So then I think the package can fit together as long as you see that, as long as you're prepared to say that the objections to Keynes is that one. It is the one that it's not sufficiently pragmatist, and see Ramsey as on the same side as Lewis in thinking that insofar as we have any kind of notion of objective chance, mm-hmm. it's one which has to build in the link with credence at the beginning. But if you're doing that, then I think you could say in Keynes's defence that actually. He did that all along, in a sense, and that's what the notion of rationality.
I don't know what Ramsey really thought or would have thought about objective chance, but I wouldn't have thought. I'm a bit surprised at you saying that Keynes was getting at anything like objective chance. I mean, objective chance is a sort of more theoretical notion than relative frequency. It's meant to be something that if it's there at all, it's what accounts for relative frequency. Whereas Keynes is on the logic epistemology side of probability, talking about what is good evidence for what.
I suppose I was thinking of objective chance in a Lewisian way as what properly constrains our credences. Now. If you start with that, then you can get to a story about beliefs about frequencies as well, by some new roots. But on that understanding of what it is for something to be a story of objective chance, you don't have to start with the link between chance and frequency. You start, as Lewis starts, with the link between chance and frequency. Mm-hmm.
Hugh wanted to comment on this point.
Oh, I just agree with what Rory said and replied to you there. I mean, one very good reason for thinking that Ramsey believed in objective chance at the beginning of truth and probability, he says one reason for wanting to be able to measure partial beliefs is unless we can do so, we can't match the degrees of our belief to the probabilities. And he goes on to say that what he's worried about is not Keynes' theory. In other words, there are three apparent subject matters for probability. One is credence. One is whatever explains frequencies in the world, actually nothing to do with degrees of belief unless you're really yellow. And the third one is this measure of a logical relation, which of course would be to be objective, because that wouldn't just be a matter of taste. That's what he doesn't believe in. But he believes what Carnap believes, except that he doesn't agree necessarily with Carnap about, well, sorry,
Carl, the trouble with Carlyle is that Carlyle gets the second thing wrong. He goes with what Keynes went with, instead of what Ramsey goes in on the subjective, on the non-physical side. And that's all. And then, well, then there's a question about how to read Lewis, which I think I disagree with you about as well. But that's not. But the point is that I don't think there's any problem that Ramsey has there. The reason he wants special degree belief is so that we can match our degrees of belief to the chances of which, in the last part of that paper, he discusses and made the remark that you quoted earlier.
Yes,
yes,
yeah. Well, I think we've come to the end of our time. So before we thank Dorothy, can I just say that the next, Hugh has insisted that I call the next break a comfort break. I don't like this phrase myself, but
no tea.
It's a euphemism. There's no tea. There isn't any tea, I'm afraid, but there will be, because we're moving on at 3 o'clock, we have our next session, and after that session, there will be tea. So, and so, having given that information, let's thank Dorothy for it.